Yeah, it looks like Russia's doing the same thing in the Black Sea as Iran did in the Persian Gulf. Russia is pulling a Hormuz in the Black Sea, you might say. Oh, and wait till you see what Jeffrey Sachs has to say about Israel today.
The young people in the United States rightly are aghast at how Israel behaves. This is a sea change of American politics.
Unable to defeat Russia on the battlefield, they are now relying on openly terrorist methods to wage war against our people. But no one will ever break the Russian people. This has never happened and never will.
All right, I know it was silent and it was weird, but what you just saw right there were some of the ships that are now being hit in the Black Sea with very specific advanced Russian weaponry. I'm going to tell you why this is so incredibly important. Game changer? This is the effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, we're now seeing where in just 1 week's time, 20 million people are watching us across the board between this show and some of the socials that we do. So, look, thank you. It means a lot to us. Thanks for being there for us. Let us know what you think. So here's the big news, I think, today. Russia is doing something it has never done before, at least not to this scale militarily. It has shut down the deep water ports in the Black Sea by attacking ships and infrastructure around Odessa. And that means the ships that are carrying grain and other necessary goods are no longer going to be able to get in or out of there. Russia could have, and some would argue should have, done this a long time ago. Why? Well, because Ukraine has been targeting Russian vessels in those same waters for more than a year, and Russia hasn't really responded in kind. Under orders from NATO, Ukraine has destroyed or sunk approximately 20 to 26 Russian naval warships. Sunk? They've also sunk another 75 or so smaller vessels and, you know, logistical ships. That's about, what, 100 in all? So in the past several weeks, things have changed. Because after watching not just that, but swarms of drones targeting Russian refineries, look at this video. This is also the online shopping warehouses that were hit. I mean, these are civilian centers. It's like, it would be like bombing an Amazon or a Walmart center in the United States, right? After seeing this, videos like these, the Putin administration, because that's happening inside Russia, the Putin administration decided to strike back. Seeing its own civilian infrastructure being targeted, it seemed to decide to fight fire with fire. It turns out it could be a game changer, too. And I'm going to tell you more about this in just a minute, because I'm going to break it down for you. But let's talk about something else. Yesterday, the president of Russia went to the Duma, right? The president of Russia spoke to Russia's version of Congress yesterday. It's what they call their Congress. It's called the Duma. As the British would say, he did not mess about. He went after those he calls the Russophobes for attacking Russia economically, socially, and now, as we see, militarily.
For those accustomed to seeing other countries not as equal partners, but as submissive, silent vassals, double standards are always beneficial. But we understand perfectly well what's happening. We've been facing illegal restrictions, attempts at containment, and pressure for a long time. But since 2022, the West has kicked the Russophobic machine into high gear. They're setting world records, and in two ways at once, the number of so-called sanctions and their futility, wishing to undermine the Russian state and provoke social discord in our country. They've attempted to strangle our economy, financial system, and banking sector, and undermine the potential of science, industry, and education. Moreover, unable to defeat Russia on the battlefield, they are now relying on openly terrorist methods to wage war against our people. But no one will ever break the Russian people. This has never happened and never will.
That was interesting. Did you see what he said right there, like toward the end, talking about the economy? This is one of Mr. Putin's main points, bragging rights, if you will. It's that the West threw everything but the kitchen sink to try and destroy Russia, try and destroy the Russian economy, and it failed. So is he right? Well, let me put it this way. He ain't wrong. Consider this headline. Look at this. This is a prediction, right? They were predicting back then Russia's doom. This is Reuters, right? This is because the World Bank and the IMF came out and said that Russia's economy would contract by at least 15% as a result of the war in Ukraine. Here's another one. This is JP Morgan. They came out in a Bloomberg story and they said, they go even further. They're predicting the Russian economy will be in a total collapse. As you can see right there in the headline, they're saying it'll be worse than what happened here in the 1990s, according to the headline. Fact is, they were wrong. The Russian economy did not collapse. It contracted the first year when the war started, but not by 15%. It contracted by 2.1%. And that was in 2022. Now, this last year, the Russian GDP in 2025, there's nothing for 2026 yet, 2025, it was up 1%. Up, not down. That's a hell of a lot better than Germany. That's a hell of a lot better than the UK, better than the Brits, many than most of the countries in Europe that are still predicting and trying to bring about Russia's demise. Now, some economists are actually saying or making the case that the sanctions in the long run against Russia will end up helping Russia become more economically viable in the future. It now produces what it used to depend on others to produce. That's a fact. It manufactures more of its own products since the sanctions. That means jobs, valuable assets that were left behind by Western nations. You know, I'd be here all day naming them, but, you know, Burger Kings, Coca-Colas, they left Russia. So now those companies are Russian enterprises. They're Russian businesses run by Russian workers. India used to get a modest amount of Russia's crude oil. Now it gets a third of all its imports from Russia. Russia's trade with China has just hit record levels, $300 billion a year. Nothing compared to, that's so much more than what it used to be. And it's growing. And speaking of China, with its banking assets frozen and kicked off of the SWIFT system, Russia has developed its own SWIFT system, its own way of moving money from country to country globally without asking permission of the United States or London. It's called the SPFS system. Presently, more than 160 participants have bought into it. And this next thing I'm going to tell you about is probably the most important and most startling comparable, right? Russia's GDP to debt ratio is around, 16%. That's GDP to what it owes, GDP to debt, right? How much you produce versus how much you owe. That's how much it owes compared to what it produces right now. It's been lower in the past. Now consider this. The EU countries combined GDP to debt ratio, 80%. So 16 Russia, 80% Europe. The US, it's ridiculous. The United States GDP to debt ratio, in other words, how much it owes versus how much it brings in, makes, manufactures, 122%. That's right. That means it owes a hell of a lot more than it produces. Can you imagine? So, yes, is it fair to say that Russia has somehow weathered one of the worst economic castigatory assaults ever handed down on a country? Yeah, it has. But now Europe, seeing that the Russians have, darn it, we weren't able to destroy Russia with our economic sanctions and the freezes and all that other stuff. So now what do we do? Okay, I know, they say, we're going to hit Russia with missiles, deep strikes on its energy, its commercial and its civilian targets. That's happening right now. And the fact that they're doing that, hitting wild berries, gets us to what is happening in the Black Sea. So what is happening in the Black Sea? Let's go. I want to show you. We put a map together so you can see what's happening in the Black Sea, because I think this is really fascinating. So this past week, it happened. Much of the port of Odessa, right, was shut down. That means Europe's traffic along the Black Sea has essentially been shut down. This is huge. It's happening mostly around this area you see right here. You see that? It's called the port of Chernomorsk. Right? Also called Ilichesk, right? Just south of Odessa. It's a critical container terminal, one of the biggest in the world, located just south of Odessa. Maersk, you know those ships when you go to the, when you, if you live near the sea and you go and you see them, M-A-E-R-S-K. It's one of the biggest shipping companies in the entire world. You see them everywhere. They just decided they're officially suspending all of their services in this region. No more service in the greater Odessa region. In fact, just this week, they halted all of their services. Why? Well, because of Russia's new weaponry and missile attacks. Look at this. This is what Russia finally decided to do in lieu of what Ukraine and Europe has been doing, hitting their civilian targets. These are tankers being taken out by very specific Russian weaponry, glide bombs, etc. And it's had a very serious effect. In fact, for the first time since 2023, all the traffic along Ukraine's Black Sea corridor, right, stopped. Sound familiar? Sounds like what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz, right? Sounds like what Iran did to take control. And why is it stopped? Well, it makes sense, really. Independent ship owners are refusing to risk their crews or their vessels. They're saying, hell no, we're not going to go there. It's not just Maersk, by the way. The world's second largest shipping line just announced that they're pulling out as well. And they're the guys who are Ukraine's largest grain exporter. So they're the ones who get all of Ukraine's products out of the country. So now they're going to have nothing coming in and nothing going out. So what are the Europeans going to do, right? What are they going to be able to do? What are their proxies in Europe going to do? What is Ukraine going to do? Well, there's talk that what they might do is instead of coming in through here to bring their goods in and out of Ukraine, they're going to come in through here. See this brown here? That's Romania, right? And Romania might allow them to use their land to come in here, and they're scrambling to find different ways, if not through Romania, some other way, to come into Ukraine. But, you know, that's tough. If you look at the map, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that between the financial overhead, the heavy transit delays, that's going to make this choice very expensive, very time-consuming. Not to mention, running trucks into a war zone, that's never going to be sure-proof. I just went up to my office and I had a conversation with Scott Ritter. And we talked about, I asked him what's his take on this development that's taking place now. Is it a game changer? What's it mean? Here's what Scott said. Take a listen.
Ukraine has been posturing itself as, you know, evicting Russia from the Black Sea. They've bragged about this. Ukraine has also worked with the West to create, economic lifelines through the guaranteed ability to transport ships, grain-filled ships out of their ports, a corridor, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But they've abused this relationship to use it to attack Russian shipping, to launch drones, et cetera. What Russia is doing right now is basically saying no more. We're not playing this game anymore. They've closed down the Black Sea to Ukraine. Ukraine isn't going to be able to, you know, receive shipping or ship anything out. It's over. It's closed down. But this also is a recognition by Russia that Ukraine can never again have access to the Black Sea. I think that is an indication that the strategic direction of Russia is to follow through on Vladimir Putin's previous statements that Odessa is a Russian city. Also a recognition of the absolute requirement to deal with Transnistria, to build a land bridge connecting Russia to Transnistria and absorb that territory, the Russian population in that territory. I think this is a signal that the new strategic direction of Russia is to remove Ukrainian access to the Black Sea by physically taking over this territory and absorbing it into the Russian Federation.
Taking Odessa.
It's a Russian city.
Wow. So think about that, because that's exactly what he is saying about the fact that Russia would eventually not just own the Black Sea, which it seems to right now, but eventually move into Odessa as well. He's not the only one who's thinking that might be the case. Now, combine the Odessa situation with the massive protests that we've been showing you over the last couple of weeks, the forced mobilizations where citizens are fighting with military officials in their neighborhoods, the lack of soldiers, right, along the front lines, right? The fact that Kramatorsk is about to fall probably within the next couple of weeks. And you know what you got? A collapse. So here's the irony. Ukraine is starting to look exactly like what the experts predicted that I just showed you a while ago in those articles for Russia. So who's collapsing now, right? Let's do this. Here's a guy who's been talking about this as well. It's time for our special weekly Eye on Europe segment with Jay Bose. He's good enough to join us to tell us what he's talking about on this particular day. Jay, where you at and what you got?
Well, Rick, good to see you. You know, and it all fits in perfectly. You talked there about Vladimir Putin, what he said at the beginning of the Russian intervention back in 2022 into Ukraine, you know, denazification, demilitarization of Ukraine. And you see what could be on the cards for Odessa. What I'm talking about is something we visited last week. You remember we were talking about Germany, yeah, its militarization, the parallels between, you know, after the First World War, economic collapse in Germany, this vacuum into which the Nazis kind of slipped. Check out this headline. This is a company in Germany called Varta, V-A-R-T-A, Varta Batteries. Now, they're one of the biggest battery makers in Germany. Well, they were. They're about to collapse, okay? They're under huge pressure. Now, this company is 135 years old, Rick, okay? It began 135 years old. This is one of the grandees of this massive German powerhouse that is the central beating heart of Europe's economy, okay? So Varta is going for insolvency. It's in serious trouble. 5,000 employees. So you might say, okay, yeah, it's another big industrial company going boom and going bust in Germany, right?
Yeah.
But I've been looking into the background of Varta, okay? Now, Varta was owned by a very interesting man, okay? Now, he was it was a particular individual called Gunther Quandt, okay? Now, I'm going to show you a picture of Gunther Quandt, okay? And it's a picture of Gunther Quandt with his wife, Magda. Okay, check out this image of them together. Okay?
Oh, whoa! Is that a Nazi uniform?
Well, that's actually his son. Okay, his son Harold. Okay, in the picture, the female you see there is Magda. Okay, now Gunther Quandt, the father of Harold, circled, is with Joseph Goebbels. This is Goebbels. This is Joseph Goebbels, stepson. Okay, now Harold Quandt went on to own Varta because his father, Gunther, was the first wife of Magda. Now, imagine, isn't this insane?
Yeah. Okay.
So the old money in Germany that owns the factory that's about to go bust after 135 years used slave labor. Okay. Absolutely remarkable stuff. Okay. Now, there's another picture of Harold, who was not only the chairman of Varta, but he also was on the board of Daimler-Benz. He was on the board of BMW. And his daughter, there's Uncle Adolf behind them at the wedding of Goebbels. And that's Harold in the front in his Hitler Youth uniform. Okay?
Wait. You said Uncle Adolf. Is that Hitler?
That's Hitler behind the man who owned Varta Batteries. Yeah,
remarkable stuff,
a remarkable story. Now, why is this important, I hear you say, okay? Well, it's important for two reasons, okay? We're constantly told by Germany, okay, and other European countries who are funding the Ukrainian dictatorship, essentially, that there are no Nazis in Ukraine. We had Laura, the loony loomer, saying there's no Nazis in Ukraine, okay? Yeah. And
while they were marching across the street while she was saying that, by the way.
Exactly. Now, often here in Europe, you'll hear, you know, this is just a sort of a Russian imagination, okay? Yeah. Now, the story about Varta going bust, okay, 135 years later, and the fact that the man who owned Varta and his granddaughter now is one of the richest women in Germany. They made that money with slave labor from the Soviet Union, from the Jews of Europe, and it all ties everything together. There's no mention in the European media here about the real background to Varta Batteries, the real background to Daimler-Benz, Krupp, Siemens, all these massive industrial companies that were built on Nazi money, Rick. It's an incredible story.
Yeah, and by the way, just to be fair, because I want to be fair to my German friends, it's not just Germany. If you go into the United States, and if you go into the UK, and if you go into parts of France, you will find corporations that excelled, survived, profited as a result of the investments they made or the money they stole right during World War II or post-World War II. And some of the biggest names in the United States have direct ties to Germany.
Yeah.
And it's caused during World War II. It's true. Yeah.
One final thing to finish. The great Russian marshal, Georgi Zhukov, he very famously said after the war, he said, you know, we've rid Europe of fascism, but they'll never forgive us.
Well said. Che Bose, as usual. Good reporting, my friend. Thank you, Che. Speaking of potential failed states, comparing it to Ukraine, one of the world's most respected geopolitical analysts is now saying, you know, if things continue at this present pace, Israel could be looking at its own collapse pretty soon. Yeah, I saw this over the weekend and I thought, wow. Listen to Jeffrey Sachs explain what might be happening in Israel when he made this point over the weekend. Here it is.
I don't see any kind of renovation of Israeli politics in this line. I don't think they have a clue as to how endangered Israel is. The world is in revulsion. The United States politics has turned. The young people in the United States rightly are aghast at how Israel behaves and have absolutely no affinity, give no support to Israel. This is a sea change of American politics. And since the United States is the only backer of Israel in the world, it's the warning I have repeatedly given to Israel, not that your behavior is homicidal, which it is, not that that it's genocidal, which it is, but that it's suicidal.
Suicidal. So when we come back, what happens in a world where maybe Israel collapses, where China becomes the world's leading economy, where it has the most gold, where Russia has the most hydrocarbons, not to mention nuclear warheads, Iran controls the passages in and out of the Middle East? What happens in a world that looks like that, which is so much different from the world we've grown up in? We're going to talk about this with a global economist who's going to join us right here in just a little bit. Don't go away. Hey, welcome back, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. I'm so glad that you're there. So really, I mean, think about what's happening right now in the world. What happens if Israel loses its grip on the Middle East? What happens if India keeps rising? What happens if China owns all the gold? What happens if Russia continues to control all the oil and Iran rules the roost in the Middle East? These things are kind of happening. May not be too far off. Alex Craner's a market analyst. He's an author, and he's a former hedge fund manager. He's based in Croatia, and you can follow him, by the way. He's on YouTube, and he's on Substack, and he's good enough to join us now to have a conversation about what's going on in the world. What do you make of that, Alex? The idea that all those things that I just said are either happening or may soon be happening in unison. What happens to the global economy if all those things come to fruition?
Rick, thank you for having me. It's an honor to join you today. I think we're going into a very severe market transition. Social, economic, and political transition that unfortunately will not fail to affect the Western world. It's a transition from a 500 or 600 year continuity of a certain global order, which was very much Eurocentric. Mm-hmm. The United States has taken up the mantle of this system as the, let's call it the military enforcement arm of the Western Empire. And I think that now this empire is running on fumes and the transition will not fail to take place in favor of multipolarity, in favor of the rising Eurasian century or millennium.
Let's take them one at a time. I think this is fascinating. Let's start with Israel, since we just saw our friend Professor Sachs talking about the fact that Israel cannot hang on in its present state. What happens if Israel is de-emphasized and Iran rises in that region?
Well, that transition happens in Eurasia, right? In Western Asia. Israel was created in the Middle East as a beachhead into the Middle Eastern region. It was created by the British Empire, and it was created exactly for the reason of keeping the region destabilized so that the Western powers would be able to assert and maintain hegemony in the region. Hmm. They knew it was a critical trade crossroads between not just East and West, but also between North and South. And then it's also an extraordinarily resource-rich region. So to maintain Western hegemony over the Middle East, it was necessary to create a permanent beachhead, or what the American officials often called an unsinkable aircraft carrier.
Hmm.
The British were quite explicit about it before Israel was ever created, right? We had the 1916 Sykes-Picot Agreement. We had the 1917 Balfour Declaration, which I think today would be called Balfour Memo, because it was nothing, it was just a short memo, which for some reason was given this exalted legal status as a foundation for creating a whole nation at the expense of the indigenous population.
Really?
The people who were actually pulling the strings were was the so-called Alfred Milner's Round Table Group, of which Nathan Rothschild was a member. And Nathan Rothschild was the son of Sir Lord Walter Rothschild, who was the recipient of the Balfour Declaration. And Arthur Balfour was also a member of that same Round Table Club. And so it was a memo from one buddy to the next who happened to have been the son of
what a coincidence. So you're telling me
the
people who ended up being the bankers, the financiers, and who set up the hegemony, which started through Europe and eventually ended up mostly through the United States and other Western countries, just happened to be sitting at the table when they created the nation of Israel. Wow. That's crazy.
Yes, yes, exactly. And then the certain alumni of this round table organization, much later, maybe in the 1920s, gave an interview to the Manchester Guardian in which they said, "Well, you know, we were thinking that if the Great Britain wanted to remain a maritime empire, it was absolutely essential to cede that region, meaning the Levant, Palestine.
Yeah.
It was absolutely essential to cede that region with a particularly patriotic stock. And so, you know, that's the key to the creation of Israel. And to this day, Israel is fulfilling that role, meaning keeping that region permanently destabilized in order for the Western colonialist powers to maintain their hegemony there.
Yeah.
And the purpose of that hegemony is to basically extract the region's wealth towards the Western financial centers like London and New York.
I've never heard anyone put it as well as you just have. I mean, you hear the case from people in the United States and others who are Israel supporters about, you know, it's a Jewish state, and this is about the Holocaust, and, you know, this is about anti-Semitism, and this is about protecting a people who are biblically belong in this area. And what you just said to us and to our millions of people watching all over the world, bullcrap. This was always and still is about hegemony. It's about controlling the power, controlling the region, and controlling the money. And that's the reason for Israel's real existence. That's powerful. So obviously my next question is, if the hegemony, as you said earlier, the UK, it's like this tiny little country in the middle, somewhere above Europe now, they don't seem to matter so much. The United States is obviously getting its butt whipped in Iran. Israel seems to be having some very internal problems. Between the three of them, if one of the three goes away, if two of the three goes away, the third is standing on its own. And if Israel has to stand on its own, it's toast, right?
Israel isn't standing on its own. And I think that this was very clear to people near the centers of power for a very long time, because I think it was, I don't know exactly when he said this, but Hassan Nasrallah, who was a very, very respected geopolitical strategist before Israel assassinated him, he said, he predicted that Israel would never see its 80th birthday. So we are now, what, less than 2 years from that watershed moment. And if people don't like to, if people don't like to take it from Hassan Nasrallah because he was a Muslim and he wore a turban, Henry Kissinger in 2012 said that Israel, there would be no more Israel in 10 years. And Kissinger's prediction would set the demise of Israel in 2022. So he was early, but Henry Kissinger did understand something about power dynamics to make that prediction, which at the time in 2012 was quite controversial. It was very spectacular. You know, nobody at the time thought that there was the time was running out for Israel.
Yeah.
But today we see that it is, because without the support from the United States, from the United Kingdom, which is extremely important, even though it's almost never discussed, United Kingdom, which godfathered Israel, is still extremely active in support for Israel. And let's say other Western powers, Israel would be completely unsustainable and it would die a very, very quick death.
And just to put a punctuation on this, and you think that is likely to happen at some point here soon?
Yes, I do. But these things are extremely difficult to predict, and it's extremely difficult to put a precise time frame on that. But I think that, you know, a nation that is completely dependent on external powers for its support, militarily, financially, and economically, which is a foreign body in the region, which is surrounded by, you know, if we're talking about Arabs, about 100, 110 million Arabs who are hostile to Israel. Israel is not exactly on friendly terms with Turkey either, and it's not on friendly terms with Iran either. So we're talking hundreds of millions of people in the region who are indigenous to their region, who have civilizational roots on that region, are hostile to Israel, whereas Israel is there as a foreign body that depends for its existence on powers that are very remote. United States, yeah, which is fighting wars 10,000 miles from home. It has strained logistical chains. It has exhausted, depleted, and demoralized military. And this is who's supposed to give Israel its security guarantees. It's, I mean, my kids can tell that this is not going to work out for a very long time.
Exactly. You know? And most people's kids in the United States, by the way, say the same thing. Like 80% of them under the age of 35 are now saying they want nothing the hell to do with Israel, and they think that they're committing genocide. 60% of Americans of all ages are now saying they don't want their money to be sent by Israel. Those are big numbers, and those are the kinds of things
that we've never seen anything like that. Turns out that genocide is not popular with the people. Who knew?
Yeah, what a concept, right? Let's do Russia next. I think Russia is a fascinating country. If Russia can do what it has done with the weight of the world, with a boot on its head, literally, freezes, sanctions, everything that they can possibly throw at them, and they have a higher GDP than most European countries, their debt to GDP ratio is between 12 and 16%, the United States is 122. What would Russia do if they end this war and suddenly some of those things are gone? How big an economy, how powerful, how important might Russia become?
Russia has certainly become a superpower in this world again, and it will probably remain a superpower. But Russia, unlike the Western colonialist powers, has never been interested in colonizing the rest of the world. I think that, unfortunately, Russia cannot stop its struggle against the West once it finally defeats Ukraine. And by this, I'm not saying that Russia will continue its military campaigns towards Western Europe, but there will be there will be a struggle that's going to continue for a very long time on the diplomatic in the diplomatic domain, mm-hmm. in the legal domain, because Russia has been plundered by Western powers repeatedly. Last time during the 1990s, I know that there are hundreds of investigative files that have been put together by the KGB and by the Russian police about many, many illegal transactions where literally hundreds of billions of dollars of Russian wealth has been extracted from Russia to the Western financial centers.
Huh.
Primarily, City of London, United States, and British, the 14 offshore financial centers in...
You know, were the Russians... Let me just say it. Were the Russians just stupid? Because it looks like a stupid thing to do. It's like, yay, we're not going to be communists anymore. Come and take whatever you want. Show us what we're supposed to do. I mean, they laid down for the West, didn't they?
No, it wasn't quite like that. You know, it was the political victory of Boris Yeltsin and his political clique, which was very quickly surrounded by Western financial and economic advisors.
Hmm.
And they, you know, putting Boris Yeltsin into the Kremlin was a calculated move because they knew him. They knew that he was a blowhard in a way. You know, he wasn't very interested in work. He worked on average 2 hours a day. The rest of the time he ate, drank, played tennis, and went hunting. And he was basically
signing...
Sounds
like a great life. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, exactly. He signed everything that these Western advisors put in front of him. He ruled by decree. And basically... It wasn't stupidity so much, Rick, as at that moment in history, Russian people just experienced a complete collapse of the system in which they grew up. And so it was a disaster. Half of the Russians lived below the poverty line, half of those in destitute poverty. The GDP collapsed by about 50%,
wow.
even by some measures worse than during World War II under Hitler's invasion. The life expectancy collapsed to something like 56 years. So it was a disastrous moment for Russia. At the same time, the West looked like the proverbial shining city on the hill.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to the people, it seemed like they got it right. We got it wrong.
Yeah.
Now they're here and they're very friendly to us. And so they're giving us advice. So, you know, at that moment in time, it seemed like
the
going
right,
along with Western advisors.
The right thing to do. Yeah.
It was the right thing to do.
Yeah,
and they look how friendly they are to us. They want us to be like them.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, you know, the people believed it. And of course, there were people like Evgeny Primakov who never believed that. But there were also people like Boris Yeltsin and Mikhail Gorbachev and, you know, that side of the spectrum who thought, hey, you know, they got it right. Let's just follow their example
and
take their advice.
And it wasn't necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't mean they're bad people. It means they got fooled. This may surprise you, but I've been fooled a few times in my life, too. And I know that there are...
No kidding. Yeah, We all were.
There are people who come with beautiful...
I used to like Bill Clinton.
Yeah. And I liked, our president now with everything he said before we got elected and promised me that he was not going to go to war in Iran. And here we are in a war with Iran. So, yeah, we all can get fooled. So maybe the word stupid was a little harsh on my terms, but it certainly has been a turnaround. That's the real story here, because
yes.
I think the Russians have bucked up and basically said to themselves, we will. That was Putin's speech yesterday. If you listened to Putin at the Duma yesterday, that's what he was saying. He was saying, these guys, they've been fooling us for decades. We can never believe them. We never should believe them. They are Russophobes. There will always be Russophobes. And from now on, anything we do with them will have to be measured on strict terms. And I think that's kind of what he was saying yesterday. And obviously, he's right. Right?
Yeah, but you think, you know, I would like to say this. The Russians shouldn't feel special about Russophobia, because we're talking about an occult oligarchy in the West, and they equally hate everybody who pushes back against them.
Yeah.
You know, they hate the Irish almost more than they hate the Russians. They can't make up their mind whom they hate more. And they hate the Chinese, and, you know, they hate the Iranians.
Yes.
They hate everybody who doesn't submit to them, and those who do submit to them, they don't hate them. They just have a certain searing contempt for them and happily brutalize them. And you know, it's the Epstein class, to sum it up in one word.
Let's end then with China and India. I think that's all that we've left out. And those are two interesting countries that are kind of starting to come together while they've been very separate for many, many years. And I say that because we just talked about Russia. We talked about Iran coming out as a force. We know the power of India just by its numbers. And we know economically what China's doing right now, especially with gold and currency. How important to the equation are those two countries, or would you separate them?
I think they're both extremely important, but I would separate them because I think that China is at a much, much more advanced stage in their own philosophy and strategy, in the sense that the Chinese know who they are and who they want to be. I think that India is still more in doubt, you know, almost kind of like Russia during the 1990s, in that you have a powerful nationalistic movement, but a big segment of the political spectrum that still thinks that the winning move is being closer to the West.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that they still haven't digested the fact that tying your fortunes and your future to the West is the losing move.
And the
Chinese, I think, have completely transcended that Stockholm syndrome.
What is that quote? Was it Kissinger? I think it was Kissinger who said it. No, I think it was Winston Churchill who said it, and Sachs says it all the time as well. Being a enemy of the United States is dangerous. Being a friend of the United States is fatal.
Yes, that was Henry Kissinger.
It was.
And I think that the Gulf kingdoms are learning this lesson
right now.
Yes.
With what's going on. They trusted the United States would protect them. They thought the economic relationship, and by giving Donald Trump a really cool plane, would save them from any harm, and they're being harmed very badly right now. How do you think that'll end up? What happens with these kingdoms in the Gulf states? What happens in the future if this thing continues the way it's going?
If it continues the way it's going, they will cease to exist. And I didn't think that I would say this about the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia until 3 days ago, when the Ansar Allah reopened their hostilities with Saudi Arabia. Hmm. The war between Saudi Arabia and Yemen ended effectively in 2022, but it never ended formally. There was a peace treaty was never drafted or signed. And now the payment is due, you know, because the Saudi war against Yemen was extremely brutal and extremely ruthless. 25,000 bombing raids, close to 400,000 casualties, most of which died by disease and famine, not through bombing.
50,000 children.
Yeah. 50,000 children.
Yeah.
Economic blockade and embargo. So it's been devastating for Yemen. But guess what? Neither Saudi Arabia nor its political patrons in the West, the United States and UK, nor their whole coalition, because this was a coalition of, countries including UAE and Jordan and Egypt and Morocco and so forth. They didn't achieve their strategic objectives. They didn't dislodge Ansar Allah. They didn't defeat Yemen. Yemen survived. Not only did it survive, it became more powerful, and now it became more assertive and more confident. And so now Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is squeezed between Iran and Ansar Allah.
Yeah.
Their oil exports have been practically cut off. The only viable route left over is the Suez Canal, but you cannot send very large crude carriers through Suez Canal. There's a size limitation.
But if the Houthis actually shut down the Strait of Al-Mandab, they're not going to be able to get through the Red Sea to the Suez Canal, right?
Yeah, you will be able to send Suezmax tankers.
Oh, to the northern part. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
But this still severely limits Saudi oil exports, which now apparently they're down by more than 50%.
Wow. And
Saudi Arabia is one of the world's largest crude oil exporters.
Yes.
Their source of revenue dwindles to close to nothing. Will there be social uprisings in Saudi Arabia? Will the kingdom survive? This is all now very much in jeopardy. And I think that neither the Ansar Allah nor Iranians strategically have any incentive to stop what they're doing, because they're gaining the upper hand. And so any ceasefire would be a gift to their enemies, which, you know, Western colonial powers have been harassing Iran now for more than 120 years.
Wow.
And Iran wants to end this once and for all, not just preserve a slightly better version of the status quo.
That is so well said. That is exactly what it seems like, not only that they want to do, but that they're actually executing on, which is fascinating.
Correct.
The way the pieces of this puzzle, as you and I just took our viewers through it, have come together, all because one day Bibi Netanyahu and Marilyn Adelson, or whatever the hell her name is, Madeline, whatever, decided to put enough money or the wrong ideas, or for whatever reason, Donald Trump decided to go into Iran, and that one move seems to have destabilized or stabilized, depending on how you look at it, much of the world to make it go in what looks like a different direction. What a great conversation. Alex, I really enjoyed talking to you. You're such a smart guy. Thanks so much for being with us. Would you let our viewers know how they can reach you or where they can check you out, watch you, connect with you?
Oh, I have two publications on Substack. One of them is my personal publication called Alex Craner's Substack. Mm-hmm. One of them is a daily trend following newsletter for investors, which is called iSystem Trend Following. I'm active on X. My handle is at Naked Hedgy. Hmm. And I also recently relaunched my YouTube channel, but that's a lot of work, as you probably know. So it's only one video every few weeks.
Yeah, and then when you get a lot of people watching you, you get demonetized because they don't like what you're saying. So be careful with that.
They all think it's AI. They all think it's AI.
Yeah, exactly. All right, my friend. Enjoyed the conversation. We'll do it again.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to join you. And warm greetings to everyone from Croatia.
Thank you. And from Moscow. And from Moscow as well. That's it from us. By the way, remember, you can always find us on X. We're big there. We're also on YouTube, but who the hell knows what's going to happen there. Spotify. People love to take us jogging, apparently. We're now on Instagram. We're now on Facebook. We got thousands of people going in there every week. I don't know. I don't know much about Instagram. My daughter does, though. By the way, on BitChute, my favorite place to put all of my stuff, I recommend you do the same thing, because you'll never be demonetized there and they'll never make it disappear. Thanks so much for being with us. And most of all, as I always like to say, thank you for letting us into your homes. We'll see you next time. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we're out.